we didn't get too far as the number of slides is concerned. We're on slide 3. And the photograph that makes up the background of this represents an ecosystem. But the specific ecosystem doesn't matter. This is just an example as far as the point of the slide is concerned. There's a couple of important points to make here. One is that for any given ecosystem, there is a throughput of energy, which means energy enters an ecosystem, and then energy eventually leaves the ecosystem. That's what I mean by throughput. It's not to say, though, that this is the same energy leaving as entering. Energy enters as sunlight, represented by the yellow arrow, but then multiple times that energy gets transformed and transferred within the ecosystem. The difference between those two is that transform means to turn into a different form of energy, so it doesn't remain as sunlight. It could be sunlight and then chemical energy and so on. That's transformation. Energy transfer refers to energy being moved from one object to another within the ecosystem. Eventually, though, energy leaves the ecosystem as heat, which is not represented here by an arrow, but you can imagine one coming out of the bottom or the side. That's different, though, from how materials operate. That was energy I just talked about, but materials more or less stay within the ecosystem and get recycled. So all materials are made up of atoms. Now the arrangement of the atoms changes. So there's various chemical reactions occurring within the ecosystem, but the materials don't come in and then leave. Of course, it's not perfectly true. There is a little bit of leakage from one ecosystem to another, but generally speaking, the materials of an ecosystem stay pretty much within that ecosystem. Okay. We can see a little bit more of that in slide 4. Once again, sunlight is the input of energy. Energy comes in as sunlight, but it doesn't stay as sunlight. For instance, the photosynthetic organisms of the world absorb some of that sunlight and transform that energy from radiant energy or electromagnetic energy, which is what sunlight is, into the chemical energy of the sugars that photosynthesis produces, which can then be put to use when eaten as food by, for instance, us animals, into energy of motion, allowing us to move around and so on. But eventually, energy leaves the ecosystem as heat. And heat is energy, but it's, in a sense, what's left over. Heat is not energy that can be put to use for work. So in a sense, it's waste. Now we'll talk a lot more about this when we get to the appropriate unit. Like I said, this is a catch-all chapter, but we're kind of getting our head of ourselves. We'll talk much more about energy in Unit 3. All right, let's go to 5. This is a specific example of the fact that in biology, there is a close relationship between form and function, biological form and biological function. What I mean by that, by form, I'm talking about how an organism is built, its structure. And by function, I'm talking about how it works. And what I mean by saying that there's a close relationship between the two is that things are structured the way they are in organisms because that's what happens to work well in the situation in which those organisms are living. Now, what is it that actually leads to this situation? Why is it that form follows function? How did it get to be that way? Yes, it is true that because this works because of adaptation. But what leads to adaptation? That's a necessary part of the process. But what is it that Darwin is famous for?
Natural selection.
Natural selection as a mechanism of evolution. Yeah, he's not. Evolution simply means change. Evolutionary adaptation means change in such a way that the population gets better and better fit to the environment in which they live. And so that's why, over time, populations, or the organisms that make up a population, have are made of structures that work well for their situation. It's because that particular structure, which happens kind of randomly, is what was selected for by nature, by that set of conditions in which those organisms live. So this is just a specific example. There are millions of examples you could use for this, so the particular example doesn't really matter much, but let me just explain what's happening here. We're looking at a bird bone, and birds have a reputation of being really fragile things, but they're really not for their size because they fly. Well, at least most species fly. And so they have to have a skeleton that has to withstand tremendous forces, a lot more force than us just walking around. Flight puts a lot of stresses on the skeleton. And if you look at the interior of a bone by cutting it away, as you see in the photograph, you'll see that bird bones are mostly space. They're largely hollow. We said that there are pneumatized bones. This white marker isn't going to work very well. Pneumatized simply means air-filled. In fact, actually, birds breathe. Part of their the pathway of their air that they breathe goes through their bones, but that's not the point of this slide. The bones are hollow, though. And this makes sense as far as what the bones are supposed to accomplish is concerned. And what the bones are supposed to accomplish is to be strong enough to withstand forces that would otherwise bend or break the bones. And this typical bone is tubular. I mean, it's a longish bone that needs to withstand torsional force. Torsional force is the force of trying to bend something. Well, natural selection is not a design process, because what causes the differences that that nature selects for is really a random process. Mutation of DNA just happens randomly, and that's why there are different versions of there are different traits that organisms in a population have to begin with. Simply randomly. And then nature selects for the things that actually work. But even though that's not at all a design process, it's kind of useful here to imagine trying to design a bird bone. If you were tasked with designing a bone, or it wouldn't even have to be a bone, let's just say you have to design something that can withstand torsional force, can stand up to being bent. And I say, you have a certain amount of material you're allowed to use and no more. Well, one choice, it would be on one extreme, would be to make your device a rod, right? Not hollow at all. A solid rod of whatever length. But because you can't go over the maximum amount of material, that means if you make that rod, if you make it solid, it's not going to be very wide, right? It's going to have a small diameter because you're going to run out of material if it's solid. You following me here? Whereas if instead you make a cylinder of the same length, you can make it a lot more, you can make it a lot bigger in diameter with the same amount of material. Because the material is then only in the wall of the hollow cylinder. Both of them need to stand up to being bent. But think about what happens when you bend a cylinder. Let's say you're bending it right at this place where this line is. And you're bending it to a certain degree, like this. Right? When you bend this, one side is going to have to withstand being compressed. The material is going to be compressed on that side, right? And the other side, it's going to be expanded. Well, notice that as you increase the diameter, even bending it to the same degree means that the amount of compression is going to have to be a hell of a lot more, and the amount of stretching is going to have to be a hell of a lot more, the bigger the diameter is. And therefore, the object stands up to that because you can't force it to be compressed that much or stretch it that much. Whereas a thin rod you can, like a coat hanger, you can bend very easily a steel coat hanger. But if you use the same amount of steel to make a tube that's greater diameter, you're not going to be able to bend it nearly as easily as the rod. So this is why bird bones are pneumatized. Not because anything was trying to get them that way, but because random mutation eventually resulted in some birds having a little bit of space in their bones, and that was a little bit more, that was an advantage over ones that didn't. And the natural selection comes into play when all that really means, is what I'm trying to say, is that if an organism with some trait that it received randomly actually is better suited to the conditions that in which it lives, then it's going to have a better chance of living long enough to pass the DNA that actually corresponds to that trait on to the next generation, whereas the others won't have as high a chance. And that's why all of this is based on reproduction. It's why it's generation to generation. And it's why I said earlier that an organism does not evolve in its lifetime. The evolution takes place between generations. When a parent passes on the DNA corresponding to a certain set of traits to its offspring. All right. Now we'll switch gears quite a bit in slide 6. And I want to introduce another dichotomy. What dichotomy did we already talk about? Well, yeah, I gave you that as an example of the definition of a dichotomy. But what biological dichotomy? Right. There's a dichotomy with respect to cell number when it comes to organisms. Some organisms are unicellular. All the others are multicellular, two or more cells. Well, this is a totally different dichotomy, but once again, it's a dichotomy. So any given organism is one or the other. The dichotomy here has to do with type of cell. There are two fundamentally different types of cells found in life. There's a representative of one of each of these. The bigger cell is an example of a cell that we say is eukaryotic. The smaller one is prokaryotic. And I really should have mentioned them in the reverse order that I just did, because prokaryotic cells were the first cells. And so those first successful cells, which are the ancestors to all organisms now, they were prokaryotic. Those were the original successful cells. And speaking of success, prokaryotic organisms, which by the way, you can say it in one word. Prokaryotic is an adjective that describes either the cell or the organism. We can also use the noun prokaryote to mean prokaryotic organism. And similarly, eukaryote for a eukaryotic organism. You don't have to say it as a phrase, say it as one word. But prokaryotes are not only the original organisms, they are by far the most successful organisms. That's true right now, and it always has been true, and likely always will be true. But we distinguish between them, though, first of all, linguistically, just based on the words. The karyo part of each of these words comes from a root that means kernel or core. So the center or core of something. Well, when it comes to a cell, the kernel that the people who named these was talking about is this conspicuous purple thing in the bigger cell that you see here, which is the cell nucleus. And the dichotomy that I'm talking about is based on the fact that not all cells have a nucleus. Eukaryotic cells do, and the EU prefix means true or good. So the word linguistically means true nucleus. What it means to be a true nucleus is that a true nucleus has its own membrane. Now, every cell, in order to be a cell, has a membrane. It is the membrane that really defines it as a cell, structurally speaking, and forms the boundary between the cell and everything else in the universe. That one membrane for every cell is called the plasma membrane, or some books call it the cell membrane, the plasma membrane. So any cell has a plasma membrane, otherwise it's not a cell. A nucleus, if it is there, is an example of an organelle, first of all. Remember, that is one of the levels in the hierarchy of biological organization that we talked about. So a nucleus is an organelle. But more specifically than that, a nucleus is an example of a membrane-bounded organelle. And since that's the first time that I've used that phrase, let me say that there's that phrase and one that sounds very much like it that are different things. These two phrases are not the same. Membrane bounded and membrane bound. So let me just talk about this linguistically for a second. Bounded, as in membrane bounded, that bounded word is a past tense of the verb bound. To bound something means to form a boundary. Like the United States is bounded by the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans. All right? So membrane bounded means membrane enclosed. Its own membrane surrounds that thing. A membrane bounded organelle is surrounded by its own membrane. And that's what we're talking about now. But just to give you the other one, membrane bound, that use of that word bound is itself past tense. It's the past tense of bind, which means to tie. So membrane bound, like in the phrase, a membrane bound protein, that's not a protein that is enclosed by its own membrane. Membrane bound means that it is tied to, it is part of a membrane. All right? And both of the terms are used in biology, but I just want you to realize they're different. Let's focus on membrane bounded, though. A true nucleus is true if it is membrane bounded. And this purple nucleus that you see in this colorized cell, colorized photograph, has its own membrane called the nuclear envelope. We'll study that later. And so that is the basis for the word eukaryotic, a cell that has a true nucleus. The pro prefix, as in prokaryote or prokaryotic, means before. And this speaks to the fact that the original cells did not have nuclei. Prokaryotic cells are more ancient. They were on the scene for a couple billion years before you ever got the first eukaryotic cell. All right, so they are named for the fact that they were around before the nucleus was even a thing. That's the basis for the difference in the two words, but that's not the only difference between the cells in the dichotomy. It is true that a prokaryotic cell does not have a true nucleus, which is a membrane-bounded organelle, but it also doesn't have any other membrane-bounded organelles, which means that a prokaryotic cell has just one membrane, the membrane that all cells have to be a cell to begin with, which is the plasma membrane. And the smaller one here is a prokaryotic cell. This one is shown much smaller than the eukaryotic cell. Now, there's a range in sizes for any prokaryotic or eukaryotic cell. But as an average, a prokaryotic cell is only about 1/10 as big as a prokaryotic cell in each of the three dimensions. In other words, 1/10 as wide, 1/10 as long, and 1/10 as deep. So in terms of volume, you could fit 1,000, 10 times 10 times 10 prokaryotic cells into one eukaryotic cell. That's just an average, though. There's some exceptions to that. Anyway, though, because a prokaryotic cell has only one membrane and does not have any membrane-bounded organelles, it is not compartmentalized. Or it's not subcompartmentalized, maybe I should say, because there is one compartment, the overall contents of the cell that the prokaryotic cell has. That's important, right? Because that makes it a different space compared to the rest of the universe. That's why I liken cells to test tubes in which the chemistry of life, metabolism, can occur in isolation from the surroundings. So there is one compartment in a prokaryotic cell. And all of that stuff, even though it's diverse, all of that stuff making up that one cell is collectively called the cytoplasm, which linguistically means cell stuff. Cyte means cell, and plasm means stuff. A eukaryotic cell is named for the fact that it has a membrane-bounded nucleus, but it also has other membrane-bounded organelles. And we'll study those as we tour the cell in an upcoming chapter. You've probably heard of some of them, like endoplasmic reticulum, mitochondria, chloroplasts. Those are all membrane-bounded organelles as well. You find them in eukaryotic cells, not in prokaryotic cells. So this means that compared to a prokaryotic cell, a eukaryotic cell is compartmentalized, meaning that you can have different things going on in different subcompartments within the same cell, more so than in a prokaryotic cell. Since there are different compartments, there are different names to the contents of these compartments. There is a cytoplasm in a eukaryotic cell, but it's not everything inside the plasma membrane like it is for the prokaryotic cell, which has only one compartment. The light brown color here in this picture represents the cytoplasm. The cytoplasm in a eukaryotic cell is all the stuff that's inside the cell, but outside of all the membrane-bounded organelles that are inside that cell. So it excludes the purple stuff, for instance, the cytoplasm does. This is not cytoplasm, the purple. Instead, it is called the nucleoplasm, the stuff in the nucleus. And that can be chemically different from the stuff that's in another compartment. Okay, that's, I think, everything I wanted to say about 6. Let's go on to 7. When I see 7, I'm reminded to tell you that there is what we call cell theory. And one big thing that cell theory says is that cells come only from pre-existing cells, which, put another way, means cells don't just pop into existence. To get a new cell, you have to start with a cell to begin with. And that's true now, and it's been true for a long time. But when you think about it logically, it must not have always been true, right? There had to have been the first cells that didn't come from pre-existing cells. And that's also true. But that happened 4.5 billion years ago or so, when conditions on Earth were drastically different from what they are now. Earth started out very, very hot. And in fact, there was 1 billion years of Earth history before there was any life at all. It was still hot as hell after 1 billion years. But that's when the first cells organized from subcellular structures. And that's the exception. But ever since then, cells come into existence only by other cells creating those cells. An important part of cell theory. And usually what that involves is a single cell that's already there splitting into two, creating two cells to replace the one that split. And, you know, that's why you can define the beginning of you as the zygote you came from, but really, you are just a continuation of 4 billion years of cells giving rise to other cells by splitting. So that's the usual case. A cell splits into two cells. But what we're looking at in this picture is actually a little bit different. We are sexual species. Animals in general are sexual species. And there are other sexual species as well, plants, fungi. But not all organisms are sexual. The thing that really is the hallmark of a sexual species, though, is that two parents are involved in creating offspring rather than just one. And each of those parents donates a sex cell. Anyone know what the general term, a unisex term for a sex cell is? It is gamete. A gamete is a sex cell. So there's a male version and a female version. For us animals, the male version is called a sperm, the female version is called an egg. They're both gametes, though. Anyway, what's unusual about this with respect to cell theory is that here you have two cells fusing into one rather than one cell splitting into two. And that is how the zygote is created. That's what you can consider the beginning of you as an individual. But like I said, this sperm, this egg, they both represent 4 billion years of cells giving rise to new cells, and eventually they got together just recently. Anyway, once you form this zygote, then you have the more usual happening occur with respect to cell theory, which is you don't stay as a single zygote very long, single-celled zygote. That zygote splits into two cells, each of which split into two to become four, and so on. You're a mass of cells, even in the very early embryo, way before a woman even knows she's pregnant. Yeah.
Is a zygote only in reference to humans?
No, any sexual species has a zygote. And we'll actually get much deeper into that as well later on in the term. Okay, so that's how you became, you know, you're not just a huge zygote now. You are a human-sized mass of cells that started out as one cell that kept splitting. And that's why you're now about 100 trillion cells. But to bring up the thing I said earlier about prokaryotic cells being successful, if you think about your body, yes, it's true that there's roughly 100 trillion cells in you. Those are cells that you can claim, in a sense, because those are cells that have your DNA. But the space that you call your body, the space that you are occupying, is really made up by far of mostly bacteria, which are prokaryotic cells. Because despite 100 trillion being a huge number of cells that are your own cells, for every one of those 100 trillion cells, there are between 10 and 100 bacteria that live in and on you. So you're vastly outnumbered, even though you call it your body. And we tend to ignore things that are invisible because we're so visually oriented as animals. But nothing comes close to how many individuals there are when you think about bacteria. And that's always been true, not just recently. Always has been. Okay, let's switch gears again in 8. We're looking at just a little piece of what is a huge molecule by molecular standards. Now, all molecules are tiny from our point of view, but there are run-of-the-mill molecules, and there are much larger molecules compared to the run-of-the-mill molecules. And in one word, we can call large molecules macromolecules, which simply means large molecules. Any organism, since they are objects, since they are material, is made up of molecules, which are themselves made up of atoms. We've already talked about these two levels of the hierarchy of biological organization. But that includes both small and large molecules. You know, a water molecule, for instance, which there's a hell of a lot in your body, that's just a run-of-the-mill small molecule. It's only 3 atoms big. Here we're looking, though, at one of 4 categories of biological macromolecules. Doesn't matter what type of organism you choose, there's a huge diversity within biology, but all organisms that have ever existed, in addition to including small molecules, are made up of 4 categories of macromolecules. And those are so important that we're dedicating a whole chapter to just those 4 categories, which I'll just list now since I'm showing you one of them. Those 4 categories are nucleic acids, polysaccharides, polypeptides, and lipids. So more about all these later. Which one of the four are we looking at an example of here? DNA, and which of the four categories is that? It's a nucleic acid. That's what the NA of DNA stands for. The overall acronym stands for deoxyribonucleic acid. And so there's all kinds of different nucleic acids, but there's two major categories, DNA and RNA. Ribonucleic acid is RNA. Deoxyribonucleic acid is DNA. And it's really not possible to talk about life without mentioning this very famous molecule, DNA. Notice that the photograph of the cartoon here, the cartoon of the molecule, fades out at the top and the bottom. That's what I meant before when I said this is not the entire molecule by any means, even though this is still, just this little section is kind of big as a molecule because it's a hell of a lot of atoms just in this. But the overall length of this DNA, if it's a typical DNA found in like you or any other organism, is millions of times as long as this. So enormously big as far as molecules are concerned. Yeah. Oh, are you not seeing this ink?
No.
Do you want me to turn the light on?
No, it's good. What are they referencing?
Well, I thought you couldn't read it. They are macromolecules, the four categories. Okay, so DNA is a nucleic acid, more specifically than saying it's a macromolecule. Yes, it's a macromolecule, and specifically it's a nucleic acid. Why is it called that? How did they get their names? Why did someone name these things nucleic acids? Exactly, because they were found originally in the nucleus. So they obviously were studying eukaryotic cells when they were discovered. That's explains the name. But importantly, even prokaryotic cells, which by definition don't have a nucleus, require and have DNA of their own. They're just not in a nucleus. They have DNA for the same reason that all organisms do. And speaking of that, there are really two major functions of DNA. Now, we haven't studied this yet, and we will, because DNA is so important that more than a third of this term is going to be about DNA, but it's the ending third or more. But I'm curious whether you have any idea what those two functions are. What does DNA do? Yeah. What do you mean by the futures? Oh, features, I'm sorry. Yes, but I'm glad you said it that way because I hear people saying all the time that DNA gives organisms their traits. Right? You've heard this being said. But that's actually only indirectly true. What directly give an organism its traits are not nucleic acids, but polypeptides, proteins. Everything about you, really, you know, the way you look, the way you think, the way you taste, your personality, that's all because of the particular proteins or polypeptides that your body is able to make. The polypeptides directly give organisms their traits. And there's no limit to how many different kinds of polypeptides can be built, each of which functions a little differently. But no organism is able to make any kind of polypeptide unless it's explicitly told how to do so. And that's what DNA does as one of its functions. It tells the cell how to build a protein, even though that by itself is an indirect process, and I'll talk about why that's true later on. But the specific part of that, I'll be right there. The specific part of that that DNA performs is called transcription. So that's one of the two major jobs of DNA, transcription. And unless you have DNA that tells the cell how to build a particular protein, you're never going to be able to make that protein, and you're never going to be able to have that particular trait that that protein gives the organism. Now, what were you going to ask? No, the genetic testing, by definition, is testing the DNA, because a gene, which is what genetic refers to, a gene is really just a subset of the overall length of a DNA. There are thousands of genes within one long DNA. You have one long DNA in what we call a chromosome, and then that's sprinkled with thousands of genes. Each gene is a transcription unit, which means each gene is a set of instructions specifically for how to build one kind of polypeptide. Okay? And back to the natural selection I was talking about. When I said it was a random process, what's random about it is that DNA holds information because it's made of these nucleotides, which is what the A's, C's, T's, and G's represent. And that specific sequence of A's, T's, C's, and G's is information, just like a specific sequence of numerals is a phone number. That means something totally different from any other phone number, right? They do different things. Well, mistakes accidentally occur, and we call those mutations, and that's how new sequences come to be to begin with. And so they end up giving different instructions to the cell so that they make different polypeptides, which work not as well or better. And when they happen to work better, that's the thing that natural selection selects for. Nature selects for the proteins that work better, which is random to begin with, and therefore in the next generation there's going to be more organisms that have those that brand new kind of protein because of this brand new sequence of DNA. Okay, we'll have a lot more to say about DNA. I just wanted to introduce it with this slide. And that'll bring us to 9. And now we have to talk about feedback in general. But notice in this slide that two categories of feedback exist. You see a schematic representation of each of these two categories of feedback that are called negative feedback and positive feedback. Now, you're probably already thinking that these are opposites of each other, just based on their names, and that's true. But they're not equal with respect to prevalence. What I mean to say by that is that negative feedback is much more commonly found in organisms than positive feedback. They both exist, but negative feedback vastly outnumbers positive feedback. And that's because of something that I kind of briefly mentioned the first day. When we looked at that opening slide, we saw 7 major characteristics that all organisms share, right? The 7 things that we define life by. One of which was regulation. And regulation refers to keeping variables from getting out of hand, keeping variables from getting out of allowable limits, the range between between viable limits that can be tolerated. Well, that involves regulation. And specifically, what did I give you the definition for the maintenance of a relatively stable internal environment? Yes, that is homeostasis. Homeostasis is impossible to overstate the importance of, because without homeostasis, a word that means staying the same, which is really a misnomer. It's not true that during homeostasis things are staying the same. Things are always changing in an organism. But homeostasis really refers to not letting variables get out of a range that is livable. And a variable is anything that can vary, right? So there's all kinds of variables in life, but a really easy to understand one is temperature. pH is another important variable, but there's all kinds of variables within an organism. And there's only so warm, using temperature as an example, that an organism can get before it dies. There's only so cold that it can get before it dies. And so thermostasis, which is keeping temperature within lethal limits, is just part of homeostasis. Homeostasis is the maintenance of all the important variables. Well, back to the fact that negative feedback vastly outnumbers positive feedback mechanisms. That is because of these two categories, only negative feedback can ever lead to homeostasis. So that's why almost all feedback mechanisms are negative. They allow organisms to remain alive. Here's why. Let me give you a couple more definitions. When we're talking about regulation or a feedback mechanism in general, you have some variable. And we'll just use temperature, keep using it as an example because it's easy to understand. But for any given mechanism, feedback mechanism, there is a variable. Now, a variable, of course, can vary. That's why it's called a variable. At any given moment, though, it is at some value. Like the temperature is a certain temperature right now, or when you measure it. In addition to that, though, which is the current value of the variable, there is a desired variable, in a sense, which we call the set point. The set point is what the cell or the organism wants the temperature to be at, or the variable in general, but using temperature as an example. All right, now, the actual temperature is almost never at set point. It's almost always either above it or below it, right? It's almost never exactly at the set point. But the set point is what you actually want it to be at. If there is a difference between the set point and the actual value at the moment, then we call that difference the error. And there's almost always an error because you're almost never right at set point. But notice mathematically that there's two ways you can have an error, right? You can have an error because the true value is higher than the set point, or because the true value is lower than the set point. So those are in opposite directions. But I mention this because I don't want you to think that one of these feedback mechanisms is good for one direction and the other is good for the other direction. That is not true at all. Whether the temperature is too high or too low, it's negative feedback that can come to the rescue. And not positive feedback, ever. This is why, by the way, it is called negative feedback. Negative is the adjective of negate. And to negate means to get rid of. So negative feedback is named for the fact that it seeks to get rid of the error, which means it tries to make the variable's value exactly what it should be at set point. Negative feedback operates to decrease the error. And this is exactly what happens when you set a thermostat in a room, for instance, like the one on the back wall. You dial in the set point. You decide what you want the room to be at, and it almost never is exactly at that, right? Because the temperature is going to go up and down. Only when it happens to hit that set point is it, for that instant, exactly on. The rest of the time, there's an error. Either the temperature is too warm or too cool. And if it's too warm, negative feedback operates in the thermostat by kicking on an AC to bring the temperature back down toward set point. And if it's too low, it'll kick on a heater so that it brings it back up to set point. It works in both directions of the error. That's why negative feedback is the only feedback mechanism that can lead to homeostasis. There are plenty of examples of positive feedback mechanism in biology, even though they're comparatively rare. And almost all biology textbooks, though, use the same one because humans are familiar with it. And that is parturition, childbirth. It's a positive feedback mechanism that gives rise to birth. What happens in a late pregnant woman is that the fetus, which has been growing in the uterus, is usually upside down, and so the head is situated at the cervix of the uterus. The cervix means neck, a narrowing. That's what leads to the vagina. And the blind end of the upper end of the uterus, where the feet are, there's no opening there. That's just a blind end. And the whole organ is very muscular. Well, the bigger that the fetus gets, the more the head is trying to stretch open that cervix. And the stretch causes nervous impulses to be sent to the brain. The brain responds by releasing a hormone called oxytocin, which, like all hormones, gets delivered into the bloodstream. So oxytocin reaches all the cells that are getting the blood. But almost all of the body ignores that signal, except the uterus. When the uterus gets that oxytocin, it responds by causing, especially the blind-ended part where the feet are, the fundus of the uterus, to contract, which is going to squeeze the contents, the fetus, forcing the head even farther into the cervix, stretching it even more, which is going to cause an even stronger set of impulses to be sent to the brain, which is going to respond by releasing even more oxytocin, which is going to come back to the uterus and cause it to squeeze even more, and so the whole thing builds. That's the nature of positive feedback. In positive feedback, the error, whatever it is, continues to get greater and greater, not smaller and smaller. Now, any positive feedback mechanism is temporary. It's temporary because either it kills you, since it can't lead to homeostasis, or because negative feedback mechanism eventually comes to the rescue. Nowadays, compared to not long ago, women usually survive the process. You know, once the kid pops out because of the positive feedback, negative feedback mechanisms in her body quickly take over and restore homeostasis. That's the fundamental difference, though, between the two. Now, these schematics are showing examples that use biochemical pathways, which we'll talk about later. That's what A to B to C to D represents. A is a material that gets turned by a chemical reaction into B, which gets turned into C, and so on. And so the point here is that D, which is the final product, that is needed by the cell, whatever it is. Just D represents some sort of molecule. And it would make sense to run this biochemical pathway as long as the cell needed D, right? And as long as it continues to need D, it will keep using the D that keeps getting produced. So if it continues to need it, there's no error there. You're meeting demand. The error, though, results when it no longer needs D but keeps making it. When it keeps making it, now you have D building up. That's the error. And the nice thing about here is that D itself, whatever it is, interferes with the pathway that builds more D. So it'll shut it down. And therefore, until the cell needs D again and starts using the stockpile, this thing's going to be shut off, which is exactly appropriate. That's negative feedback. But on the positive one, W, X, Y, and then Z, more Z just produces even more Z. That's why it's positive feedback. That can never be homeostatic. Now in 10, switching gears again, this is a slide having to do with classification of organisms. And classification is just a way that humans put organisms into groups for various reasons. Humans just like to do this in general, not just in biology. We like to put things into groups. And so we have been classifying organisms for thousands of years. But for most of that history, the classification had nothing to do with true relatedness of the organisms. We just grouped things based on what they looked like to humans. So, for instance, there were two major groups called kingdoms originally, plants and animals. No other possibilities, even though there are a lot of other possibilities. We had no idea that microscopic life existed back then. Everything was either a plant or an animal. And for instance, a fungus, which is neither a plant nor an animal, because you see it growing from the ground, they said, that must be a plant. Just basically how they looked to us. Not based on really how related they were to each other. But that is what the heading here on this picture is. Each of these names, like kingdom, phylum, class, order, family, genus, species, each of those is a taxon, T-A-X-O-N, but the plural is taxa. A taxon simply means a group. So each one of these levels is a taxon. Class is a taxon, family is a taxon, and so on. As we go to the right on this slide, we're getting bigger and bigger groupings. So a kingdom is a large group. Well, by the time I got to like fifth or sixth grade and started learning this the first time, there were more than just two kingdoms. We were well beyond that. There were five kingdoms at that point. And that's only like 50 years ago. Well, now there's many more than five kingdoms that we recognize. And not only that, but kingdoms aren't even any longer the biggest taxa. Now we have an even bigger group that contains kingdoms within it. And those biggest taxa are called domains. Okay? Now, before I leave this slide, let me say that as you go to the left on this slide, you're getting more and more exclusive. Fewer and fewer things are in these groups. They're smaller groups. And at the end, using this bear as an example, we have what is called a binomial, or the scientific name. Now, binomial is part of binomial nomenclature. Nomenclature just means naming things, and binomial means two names. So the scientific name, the so-called scientific name, is always two names, right? Like for the bear here, it's Ursus americanus. But a binomial is really just a listing of the two smallest groups shown here to which this organism belongs. The two smallest groups are genus, and even smaller than that is species. Now, the proper way to use a binomial, as you can see here on the one that's, it's harder for me to print it by hand this way, but the proper use of a binomial is that both the genus and the species is italicized. They're both italicized. The genus name is always capitalized, and the species name is never capitalized. That reminds us that Ursus, the genus, is bigger than species, smaller group. Okay, so that's a binomial, just really a listing of an organism's genus followed by its species. For humans, we would be listed as Homo sapiens because we belong to a genus called Homo. And that genus, Homo, contains several species within it. We just happen to be the only ones that are still exist. All the others have gone extinct. But our species is not Homo sapiens. Our species is sapiens. And sapiens is not a plural. So don't use the word sapien, which doesn't exist. It's Homo sapiens. That's our binomial. And you would do the same thing as far as italicization and capitalization when using any other binomial. Now to 11. So I just got done telling you that the biggest, most inclusive taxa now are domains. And what we see in slide 11 is that there are specifically three domains. And you can see here that they are called bacteria, archaea, and eukarya. Three domains, but remember we talked about a dichotomy with respect to cell type. So there's two types of cells, but there's three domains. And notice that one of them is called eukarya. That domain, which we belong to, includes all of the eukaryotes that have ever existed. And that's all it includes. All of the eukaryotes and only the eukaryotes. So that's one of the two cell types, right? Eukaryotic cells is one part of the dichotomy. But there's three domains. There is no domain called prokarya, which means all of the prokaryotic organisms of the world are spread out into the other two domains. Any given prokaryote is in this domain or the other one, not both. There's no overlap between any of these domains. These are mutually exclusive. Well, domain bacteria, as you probably already guessed, includes the bacteria. All bacteria are prokaryotes. But not all prokaryotes are bacteria. So the rest of the prokaryotes, when you get rid of the bacteria, make up the other domain, which is called archaea.
Virus?
Virus is not an organism. These are organisms. So the cells, that's why they're organisms, the cells that make up archaea do not look very different from the cells that make up the domain bacteria. If you were to look at them both side by side in a light microscope, you wouldn't be able to see much difference. And that's because the really important difference between them, which is why they deserve to be in their own domains, is chemical. It's molecular, not cellular. So you'd have to take a much closer look than just with a light microscope. Despite the fact that archaeans and bacteria are superficially similar and don't seem to be much like the eukarya, which includes us, of course, really, when you get down to comparing these things ancestrally, domain archaea and domain eukarya are more closely related to each other than either is to bacteria. And bacteria are most like the first successful lineage of cells that are the ancestors to all things. All right, well, in 12, we're comparing these cartoon versions of a cilium from one organism, a paramecium, which is a unicellular protist. It's a eukaryote as well, like we are, but it's much different from us. And the blue one is from a human, a cilium from a windpipe cell, an epithelial cell lining the trachea. These are pretty drastically different organisms, right? A paramecium and a human. But when you compare the cilia, notice the cutaway view, we're looking at a photo micrograph here of the molecular architecture that really makes up the bulk of the cilium. They're almost identical, despite these two organisms being drastically different. Well, this is just one of countless bits of evidence pointing to the fact that all organisms are related if you go back far enough. Even though we are different from paramecium, we have a common ancestor if you go back far enough. In the overall tree of life, the trunk of the tree is the first successful cells. And those gave rise to all organisms, alive and dead. This just happened to be something that worked so well that it hasn't changed much since. Because if it does change through accidental mutation, the change is almost always not as good as this. So it doesn't get favored. It doesn't get passed on. When random mutation really works well, that particular protein that gets created sticks around for a long time because it's successful. Well, relatedly, 13 is a cartoon representation of natural selection. We've already talked about this a little bit, but let's look at this specific example. Here we have two populations. One is the bug population, the insect, whatever it is. That's the prey species. And the bird population is the predator species. Predator and prey have the special relationship of one being eaten by the other. The predator eats the prey. And the black background here, just for simplicity, is a black background, but it really represents a real substrate, a surface on which these insects live naturally, which wouldn't be perfectly monotone, but it's just a cartoon. So they live on a dark substrate, a dark surface. And because of mutation, which gives rise to new versions of DNA, there is in any real natural population a difference in traits from individual to individual. There's a variation within the population. And notice the coloration here. Some of them are dark, some of them are light, some of them are in between. That's because of whatever DNA they got dealt randomly when they were created by sex. Okay, now, the bird does not at all care about the color. It's not one of these that it especially enjoys eating. The bird just wants to eat to remain alive, hopefully, for another day. And so it wants to not eat a specific thing. It wants to eat in the easiest way that it can eat. By easiest, I mean using as little energy as possible. Because the more energy that it wastes trying to find food, the less energy that it gets in net from that food. And if it's on the edge of starvation, that would make the difference. Right? So it's going to, in other words, it's going to just bite at the, or peck at the first thing that it sees move. And that's where natural selection comes into play. the particular individual insects that are going to be the easiest by the bird to spot are the ones that have the highest contrast with respect to the background. In this case, since the background is dark, that means the lighter individuals are going to stand out a lot more. And so that's the ones that the bird's going to eat more than the dark ones. But think about what makes them light and dark. A particular version of DNA makes that individual either dark or light. All right? And DNA gets passed on. Oh, by the way, I forgot to mention this back when we were talking about the two functions of DNA. You should have stopped me because I said there were two, but I gave you only one. Don't be afraid to stop me. The other function of DNA is replication, which means DNA has the remarkable capacity to make an exact copy of itself, which is involved when it comes to reproduction, to creating a new cell. We talked a little bit about cells giving rise to new cells by a cell splitting into two, right? Well, if you are a cell and you are going to split into two viable cells, which means cells that have a chance of living, then not only does each of these two cells have to have DNA, just like you need DNA as the original cell, but each of them need all of your DNA, not just some of it. So the only way that this is going to work is if before splitting, you replicate, make a copy of your DNA so you have enough for two cells. And then you give each one copy. All right? That's the other function of DNA, replication. Well, so DNA gets passed from cell to cell, and also when it comes to reproduction of multicellular organisms, it gets passed on from parent to offspring. So there's a particular DNA sequence that specifies lightness as the color, and another one that specifies darkness. Any individual has just one or the other. Okay? But the more the light ones get eaten, for the light ones that do get eaten, their life is over. They don't have any possible way now to pass the light version of DNA on to their offspring, because their offspring are not going to exist. The dark ones, yes, some of them will be eaten, but they'll have a hell of a better chance at surviving long enough so that they can reproduce, and if they do, it's the dark version of DNA that gets passed on to the next generation. And that's why in the next generation after this one, that generation is going to feature a higher percentage of black individuals than white individuals. And the population has evolved. No individual. The population has evolved because this next generation in the population is now better suited to living on a black background because the darker individuals don't stand out. That's what natural selection is. And there's this is a cartoon example, but there's a famous example from the 1800s that's just like it, except the opposite when it comes to coloration. It has to do with moths, not these beetles, but the moths lived on trees mostly, spent a lot of time on tree bark, and the tree bark was particularly light, so that's what's opposite about this. It was a light-colored natural substrate that they lived on, but the moths, some of them were light, some of them were dark. In that case, the ones that stood out against their background were the dark ones. So that's because of natural selection, most of them were dark. I mean, most of them were light, I'm sorry, because they didn't stand out. That kept them hidden. But this is for thousands and thousands of years, the way things were. And then humans started the Industrial Revolution, burning fossil fuels, spewing a bunch of soot in the air that actually made the bark dark all of a sudden. And so now, all of a sudden, the selection pressure has changed because now it's advantageous to be dark instead of light. And within a generation or two, that's exactly what they saw. The population evolved so that now they are mostly dark and rather than mostly light. I see by the antsiness that I must be out of time. So let's continue.